Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Today is August 4th. Today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by speaking with economist Dan Mitchell about the relationship between tax rates and government revenue receipts. Dan is a libertarian economist and a former senior fellow at the Cato Institute. This is part of our Both Sides Now approach, where it's the first of a two-part series on the topic. Next week, we'll hear a different perspective from Corey Husak with the Center for American Prosperity. And by the way, while we're talking about our Both Sides Now series, if there's an issue that you want us to take on and present two sides of, we'd love to do that. Let us know. Mountain Money at kpcw.org. Kevin, what else do we have going this morning?
Well, this morning we're also speaking with author Patrick McGee about his new book, Apple in China. If you got one of those Apple devices in your pocket, on your desktop, whatever, you want to read this book. It's a fascinating look at the deep relationship between Apple and the center of its manufacturing base, China.
The so-called Big Beautiful Bill was signed by the president on July 4th. The Congressional Budget Office contends that the bill will add some $3.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years, largely due to a $4.5 trillion reduction in revenue. Now, some economists dispute these figures and argue that the growth effects from extending the 2017 tax cuts and other provisions will significantly offset the reductions in top rates and other factors. On the phone to discuss it is economist Dan Mitchell, former senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Good morning and thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
So, Dan, let's start by summarizing the major elements of the bill as they relate to taxes.
The most important part of the bill is that it extends the 2017 personal tax cuts, which is a collection of different provisions, slightly lower tax rates for households, child tax relief. But then it also adds a few provisions, some of which I'm not a big fan of. But they do lower taxes, you know, the provisions dealing with Social Security, dealing with overtime, dealing with tips. I worry some of that stuff will complicate the tax system. I'm a fan of the flat tax. I want the whole thing to be very simple and neutral. But by and large, an extension of the 2017 tax cut with some other provisions thrown in, very much linked to what Trump promised on the campaign trail last year.
And now there are some provisions that speak to things like accelerated depreciation and other sort of business-oriented provisions. How important are those?
Well, in terms of economic growth, I think that would be at the top of my list. Right now, we have a tax code. I mean, people think I'm joking when I say this, but it actually taxes businesses that conduct new investments. Well, every economic theory in the world says that you get more growth by having more investment because that's what boosts productivity, which makes workers more valuable and leads to higher wages and higher living standards. So the fact that the tax penalty on new investment is being reduced, I think is a very good provision. And as a matter of fact, most economists would say that is the number one most important provision in terms of economic growth. Now, I should hasten to add for your listeners, if you go back to the 2017 tax cut, the most important pro-growth element was the lower corporate tax rate, because we were way out of whack with the rest of the world. Back then, we had a federal rate of 35%, and the global average was down to like 22, 23%. They lowered that in 2017 to 21%. That provision, though, was permanent, so there is no risk of going back up to a 35% corporate tax rate if somehow there was a political stalemate and nothing happened.
So just so we understand it, what is sort of the investment penalty you just mentioned?
It deals with a very boring issue, the debate between depreciation and expensing.
Right.
Expensing, that's the simple thing to describe. A business has revenue. Some of that revenue goes to workers' wages. Some of that revenue goes to raw materials. Some of that revenue goes for new investment. In theory, all of your expenses should be subtracted from your revenue to come up with a number for profit. You know, very simple concept. You know, if you have a lemonade stand, you know, the cost of your material, the cost of the table you buy to put the lemonade on when your neighbors come by and buy a cup of lemonade, your profit is your total revenue minus total cost. That's the way it should work with expensing. Unfortunately, we have something called depreciation. And that means that if you invest, you can only recognize or for tax purposes, only a certain share of that money you spent on investment can be deducted from your revenues when you're figuring out profit. So literally, I mean, I'm not joking, literally, some of your investment expenses are mischaracterized as profits under a depreciation regime. Now, the good news is that in future years, you do get to eventually recognize all those investment expenses, but you know, money today is worth more than money 10 years from now, especially in an environment where inflation is sometimes a problem. So moving at least to some degree in the direction of expensing is a very, very important provision. And I think, I mean, if the corporate rate reduction was the crown jewel of the 2017 bill, the shift toward expensing is the crown jewel of this piece of legislation, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Now, most people listening presumably are not business investors, they're households, so they're going to be happy by the fact that their individual income tax rates are going up. The families out there listening will be happy that they're going to have lower taxes depending on the number of kids they have and things like that. So obviously, you know, what you think is important probably most of all depends on what's going to save you money so that you're not turning over more of your hard-earned income to the clowns and crooks in Washington.
Now, any other provisions in the bill that you see as stimulating growth?
I think, of course, extending the individual income tax rate reductions. I mean, is that stimulating growth or is that preventing something bad from happening?
Right.
Because, of course, if there was no bill, the rates would have gone back up automatically. So I don't know. Is that a glass half full, glass half empty way of describing the bill? But I'm going to give you a slightly different answer. I'm a big believer that the number one fiscal problem that we have as a country is a rising burden of government spending. And I also think that when more money goes to Washington, it's like giving alcoholics the keys to a liquor store. It makes the problem worse rather than better because the politicians respond by spending more money. So to quote the great late Milton Friedman, I'm in favor of lower taxes anywhere, anytime, for any reason, because at the end of the day, I hope that we have something called starve the beast, where if less revenue goes to Washington, we wind up having a lower burden of government spending.
So Dan, let's talk about one of the central arguments that we hear surrounding the bill. You know, it seems intuitive that if you reduce tax rates, you're going to reduce revenue. Can you sort of talk a little bit about why that is not necessarily or in fact the case?
Yeah, well, what you're basically asking about is what in Washington is the debate over the Laffer curve.
Yes.
And the Laffer curve on one level is completely uncontroversial. Every economist in the world, even Paul Krugman, acknowledges that if you have 100% tax rates, you're not going to collect any revenue or a trivially small amount. Maybe there are some genetic communists out there who would still work if the government stole every penny they earn. But every economist in the world that I'm aware of who's ever been asked about this agrees there is a Laffer curve. The debate is the shape of the Laffer curve. And you have some people like presumably Krugman, although I don't think he's ever written on this, but some famous left-wing economists like Thomas Piketty, you know, they say, oh, the revenue maximizing rate is 70%, 80%, whereas people like me would say, no, the revenue maximizing rate is much lower. But when I'm in that kind of debate, the first thing I always say is, I don't care what the revenue maximizing rate is, because never once in my life have I woken up and said, oh, I want to maximize revenue for government. I want to be at the growth maximizing point of the Laffer curve, not the revenue maximizing point on the Laffer curve. Now, having given you that sort of maybe a little bit pedantic explanation of my view on the Laffer curve, there are some tax cuts that actually do raise revenue. In the 1980s, when Reagan lowered the top tax rate from 70% to 28%, if you look at the IRS data and the Statistics of Income Bulletin, you can go online and do this yourself, you will see that people making more than $200,000 a year, the ones affected by those top rates, they paid five times as much revenue in 1988 as they did in 1980. So a clear case that lowering a tax rate resulted in more revenue. Now, having said that, I think that most tax cuts probably do lose revenue because we're probably not at the revenue maximizing point on the Laffer curve. But again, that's not an argument against lowering taxes because I want to be at the growth maximizing point. Lower tax rates almost always are good for growth. They're better than having higher tax rates, regardless of whether or not you lose revenue or not. Now, just because you lose revenue doesn't mean you lose as much revenue as maybe sometimes people think. Here's an analogy. Let's say that your job is to run a pizza restaurant. If you doubled the price of your pizzas, would you have twice as much revenue from pizza sales? Of course not, because customers would say, your prices are ridiculous. I'm going to go buy pizza from someone else, or maybe I'll go to a hamburger joint, or maybe I'll just cook dinner at home. And conversely, if you cut your price of pizzas by 50%, you won't have 50% less revenue, because a lot of people are going to come into your restaurant. Oh, wow, pizza prices are low. This is a great deal. Now, whether it's a smart business decision, are you pricing your pizzas below the cost of your ingredients and the cost of your labor? Yeah, but people respond to prices, and taxes are a price on being productive. Now, what's ironic is politicians understand this when they want to. They bang their fist on the table and they say, we need higher taxes on tobacco because we want people to smoke less. Well, I'm libertarian ideologically. I don't think it's government's job to tell people how to live, but you know what? I give those politicians an A+ for economics because they're right. The higher the tax on tobacco, the fewer cigarettes will be sold. But I want them to be consistent. I want them to be honest. If higher taxes on tobacco lead to less cigarette consumption, then guess what? Higher taxes on work, saving, investment, and entrepreneurship are going to lead to less productive economic behavior. So yes, by all means, always lower tax rates whenever you can. But in the long run, and I'm sorry to ramble on this answer, but it gets me all worked up. In the long run, you can't have good tax policy if you have bad spending policy. And the number one thing that worries me in Washington when looking at fiscal policy is politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, are not serious about controlling the growth of the welfare state, and especially when you factor in the aging of our population and the fact that we have poorly designed programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, we're going to be in deep trouble in 5-10 years.
I want to go back and just see if I can pick up on something. When we talk about the revenue numbers that you pointed out in 1988, you know, between the Reagan tax cut, isn't the and I want to make sure I've got this sort of linkage clear in my own mind. Isn't the reason that the revenue would have gone up directly related to the fact that there would have been growth in the economy? I mean, isn't growth really the reason that the only reason that you would have had that revenue go up?
There are several factors that caused revenue from the rich to go up in the 1980s. Economic growth, inflation. Reagan came in when there was very high inflation, and even though he was very successful in bringing it down, it still prices increased about 40%. Over his 8-year or 10-year in office. So when you factor in economic growth, when you factor in inflation, there were reasons that revenue from the rich might have gone up by 80%, 90%, 120%, who knows? But let's keep in mind the IRS data show that revenues from the rich increased by 5 times from $19.7 billion a year in 1980 to $99 billion in 1988. Yeah, now, that's a 500% increase. I mean, you don't need to be a math genius to say that, there was a Laffer curve effect going on there. Now, to be honest, we don't know whether the lower tax rates by themselves, did they cause revenue to double from the rich? Did they cause revenue to triple? Obviously, there are other explanations that are part of why they increased by 5 times. And, you ask 5 economists, you'll get 9 different answers about, what the exact ratio was. But very, very clearly, when we had top tax rates of 70%, which is, by the way, where Bernie Sanders and AOC and Kamala Harris and people like that want us to go back to. By the way, during the debate on the budget, Vice President Vance was urging higher tax rates. So it's not just Democrats that are in favor of bad tax policy. There are some Republicans who want to play class warfare as well. But what we saw during the Reagan years, and by the way, there's evidence like this from other countries as well. And here's something I should have said when explaining my answer before. Rich people are different than you and me, or at least they're different than me. Maybe you're rich and that's great. Rich people don't have a lot of wage and salary income. They don't worry about W-2 forms. Rich people get the overwhelming share of their income from investment and business sources. And guess what? When you have investment and business income, you have tremendous control over the timing, level, and composition of your income. So if politicians raise tax rates, it's very easy for you to shift your economic affairs. Maybe you dump your money into tax-free municipal bonds. Maybe you invest in growth stocks instead of dividend stocks. There are all sorts of completely legal ways to protect yourself as a rich person if tax rates go up. What Reagan did by bringing tax rates down, he sent a signal to rich people, invest in what's good for the economy. Because if you make a profit, that's good for America, that's good for growth, and you're only going to pay 28% instead of 70%, so it's not going to be a discouragement to you. So by all means, always, always lower tax rates whenever you can. Minimize the burden of double taxation, because that's a whole other problem we haven't talked about, between capital gains taxes, double taxes on dividends. We tax income that is saved and invested over and over again in a way that makes the effective tax rate just horribly high.
Now, I know you're pro flat tax. Is there an optimal income tax rate or somehow where the Laffer curve is happy?
Well, again, you have to decide what is the right point that you want to be on with the Laffer curve. Do you want to be at the revenue maximizing point? No. Do you want to be at the growth maximizing point? Yes. And the growth maximizing point, that's a derivative. It's a derivative of what revenue do you need to finance the legitimate functions of a federal government. Now, I'm old-fashioned. I think our founding fathers had the right idea of a very limited small central government, basically defend the shores and not do much else. The night watchman state, I think Jefferson was the one who described it that way. Well, unfortunately, now we have this giant welfare state in Washington. The federal government, which back in the 1800s was, 2% of GDP in peacetime, it's now 23% of GDP. So it's increased more than 10 times. And by the way, the long-run projections are it's going to get much worse because of our poorly designed entitlement programs and the aging of the population. So I'm very worried we're on a path to becoming an Italian-style, French-style, stagnant, slow-growth welfare state. And if the burden of government keeps increasing, it doesn't matter what all of us say is the right point on the Laffer curve. Politicians are going to raise taxes. They're going to make the economy worse. They're going to fuel more government spending. We see that pattern in Europe over and over again. And so I'm very pessimistic about the long run. I'm thinking of, I might as well defect to Argentina, which has the best leader in the world today, Javier Milei.
Okay, Dan, is there similar data on the Bush tax cuts in terms of stimulating growth as the information you've pointed us to on the Reagan tax cuts?
When we're talking about the Bush tax cuts, we should specify George W.
Yes.
Bush, not George H.W. Bush. George H.W. Bush, who took over after Reagan, did a tax increase,
right.
His famous Read My Lips betrayal, and that was an utter disaster. George W. Bush, in the first 8 years of this century, he came in, he did two tax cuts, 2001 and 2003. 2001 was sort of a Keynesian tax cut and didn't really have much pro-growth effect. 2003 was a much better tax cut. That's where we got the big reduction in dividend taxes and capital gains taxes. And the good provisions of the 2001 tax cut, which were delayed, they were accelerated and went into effect after the 2003 tax cut. And we did see some good effects from the 2003 tax cut. But keep in mind, Reagan reduced the marginal tax rates from 70% to 28%. With Bush, I think what he did was went from 39.6 down to 36 or something like that. So it was a much smaller tax cut. The individual tax cuts, frankly, were not as important as the reductions in double taxation on dividends and capital gains. That was the crown jewel of Bush's tenure, was the reduction in capital gains and dividends taxes.
Also, I
should say that, and this is one of the strange quirks of tax policy, we got rid of the death tax, but only for 1 year, 2010. So if you were a good financial planner, you died in 2010, because then your family didn't pay any death tax. But unfortunately, it then came back into effect after that because it was just a one-year phase out.
I have to share with you, Dan, that I had the honor or the privilege of delivering a eulogy during that year and was able to say that the person who had died could not have been happier to have chosen that year because they avoided the death tax. Dan, I want to get to the CBO number. The CBO number says that this is, you know, this big increase in the deficit. Now, we can start by talking about what's the right baseline, right? Do you use what would have happened, which is the Trump era 2017 tax cuts would have gone away? But if we, you know, if no matter which one we use, what is your reaction to those numbers? Do you think that they're reasonable? And if not, what would your number be?
I wrote a column months ago when this was all under discussion, and I shared all the numbers for the different growth estimates, the sort of the Laffer curve response estimates that everyone did. And the Republicans on Capitol Hill assumed over 10 years they'd get $3 trillion of revenue feedback. Now, that's just silly. I thought that was a grotesque exaggeration. I think the Tax Foundation, of all the groups out there that do this kind of research, I forget exactly what they estimated, but I think they had $400 to $500 billion, which is nothing to sneeze at. But Republicans greatly exaggerated simply so they could claim, at least on paper, that their bill wasn't increasing the deficit. This is an opportunity to raise a whole separate point. Is the deficit a problem? Yes, the deficit is a problem. However, the important thing to understand is that the deficit is actually a symptom of the problem. The problem is we have a government that is too big and spending too much. And whether you finance that spending by taxing, by borrowing, or printing money, those are all bad things. But all those bad things only happen because government is spending too much money. So I always tell people the most important fiscal variable in Washington is the growth of government spending. If government spending is growing too fast, in other words, is it growing faster than private GDP, then your burden is going up. And if your burden is going up over time, you're going to get higher taxes. You're going to get more deficits. You're going to get more money printing to finance red ink. So you have to control the growth of government spending. The folks in Colorado have a spending cap called TABOR, the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. It limits spending growth to inflation plus population. We need something like that in Washington. Unfortunately, they're not going to do it because, in effect, you'd be asking politicians, will you put handcuffs on yourself? Well, they don't want to do that. They get elected by buying votes with other people's money. And, of course, the problem is, let's quote Margaret Thatcher, the problem with socialism or big government is that sooner or later you run out of other people's money.
Okay, so bottom line, you sort of argued, as I understand it, that we're on this unsustainable path, right? Entitlements continue to grow, spending continues to grow. As a practical matter, how do you see us getting out of that?
Well, I'm not sure we are going to get out of it. That's why I think...
That's why you're thinking about Argentina.
Should all move to Argentina. But by the way, what a miracle that is. One of the worst governed countries over the last 100 years elects a radical libertarian, and now they've had an amazing turnaround in a very short period of time. But I don't want to be overly pessimistic. We can very easily just look back 10 years ago when Republicans were enacting, obviously Obama was in the White House, so it never went anywhere, but they were enacting the Paul Ryan budgets. And the Paul Ryan budgets had major entitlement reform of both Medicare and Medicaid. Medicaid would be block granted to the states, just like we did with welfare reform under Bill Clinton in the 1990s. And Medicare, which is the government's health program for old people, Medicaid being the health program for poor people, Medicare would have been modeled after the federal employees health program, where in effect, every old person would get a voucher to purchase the healthcare program that worked best for us. But the growth of both the Medicaid block grant and the voucher would be limited, and that would have saved trillions of dollars over the long run and given us better healthcare policy. So we know how to fix these entitlement programs. Unfortunately, that's one of the areas where Trump is weak. He doesn't want to touch entitlements because he thinks, well, frankly, I think he just thinks it's too much heavy lifting and too difficult. Well, you kick the can down the road long enough, and we're going to have a crisis that'll make the Greek crisis seem trivial because there's no way we can be bailed out. Our economy's too big. So I think it's wrong for Trump to kick the can down the road. And of course, it's wrong for the Democrats to want to dig the hole even deeper by expanding entitlements. You know, what is a principled small government Reaganite position? You know, I'm a Reaganite, not a Trumpite. I want free trade, small government, low tax rates, free markets. And Trump's good on some of those issues. He's good on deregulation and stuff like that. But he's not good on spending. And that's our number one threat as a to our economy in the long run as a country, is that we are it's a slow motion crisis. We're on the Titanic, except in this case, it's not like anyone was asleep on the bridge. We see the iceberg ahead of us. We know we're going to hit the iceberg. We have time to turn the ship, but nobody wants to turn the ship because they're worried, oh, some voters might get upset at us. But what we're seeing right now in front of our eyes in Argentina is that if you go to voters and you tell them the truth and you say, we want to salvage our economic system, we want to save the country from fiscal crisis, I think voters will be reasonable. Keep in mind, when Republicans in the House and Senate voted for those Ryan budgets 10, 12, 13 years ago, none of them lost re-election. They were demagogued about it. The Democrats had this ad showing a Paul Ryan lookalike pushing a grandmother off a cliff. But they got reelected because Republicans back then, they were sort of infused by the Tea Party spirit, and they actually went out and told people the truth. So I have more faith in the American people than today's Republicans have. But unfortunately, I'm not the one in political office.
Dan Mitchell, thanks so much for sharing your perspectives with us this morning.
Well, great. It was great talking to you guys.
We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. There are many reasons why Apple is one of the most admired companies in the world. The Macintosh completely revolutionized personal computing. The iPhone effectively created the modern smartphone that I, for one, look at far too many times during the day. Apple products are not only cutting-edge in technology, they're superb in design. But none of those ubiquitous Apple products in our lives were actually made in Cupertino or even by Apple itself. The story of how Apple came to be intertwined with China in a remarkable degree is told by Patrick McGee in his new book, Apple in China. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. My pleasure.
So, Patrick, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Well, I was the Apple reporter for the Financial Times for 4 years, and I kind of joke that the book came out of my failure as an Apple reporter rather than my success. In other words, what it is not is my 4 years as an Apple reporter, you know, articles already published and then sort of padded out into book form. I kind of flailed as an Apple reporter. I didn't know how to get inside the company. I didn't know how to cover it. And I found that I largely didn't care about most stories about Apple. I mean, a lot of so-called scoops about Apple are, does the next phone have curved corners? And I just found myself not caring. I had covered the car industry out of Frankfurt, and that's not how I covered the car industry. I cared about how the cars were made, what the Germans were going to do in their electrification attempts, and how they were going to change their business model to take on the likes of Uber or self-driving. And applying the same thing to Apple is really difficult because they don't help you. They don't want you to tell those stories. So, you know, what you said is like what everybody knows. Of course, everyone knows their products are made in China. The box says so, and sometimes the product says so. But I found in my final year covering Apple that nobody had really investigated like how exactly that came to be. And how is that the secret sauce, given that every electronic that you can think of is made in China? So what had Apple done differently? Clearly, they had done something differently. And I just didn't think we had covered the strategy. And we sort of failed to remember that Apple used to make everything themselves. I mean, literally down to the circuit board, the first Apple so-called computer, the Apple One, was literally a fully assembled circuit board designed by Steve Wozniak in the late 1970s. So this was really central to their DNA. And I just wondered, well, why did they give it up and how did they give it up? And what I found was like an absolutely fascinating narrative that eventually involves, you know, organized crime and a whole host of other fun things to write about.
Now, the book is a lot of fun because it is both a history of Apple and a story of how that relationships, how its manufacturing approach evolved. You start out by talking about Jobs, and you sort of say that he was known for his obsessive attention to detail and the need to control. How and why was that first sort of significant move where he moves to contract with other manufacturers? Was the iMac the first one that really, where they really moved to an outside manufacturing model?
So, oh gosh, it's such a nuanced answer, so I'm struggling as to how to do it. So, okay, so Apple really cared about manufacturing things themselves,
right.
But there were products that didn't have the full attention of the team. And so before the iMac, you had a bunch of products that were being made in Taiwan and Japan as early as the late 1980s and throughout the 90s. So I sort of have this chapter called Adventures in Outsourcing, which is all preceding the comeback of Steve Jobs. And to some extent, what I'm trying to do with my answer here is distance myself from the idea that this was a Steve Jobs-led initiative. The global outsourcing strategy that Apple adopts in 1996 happens during the exile years of Steve Jobs, and the history of the LaserWriter, which is like the successful printer that essentially stops the Mac from being a total failure and instead invents a whole new category called desktop publishing, that was made out of Japan. And then the Newton, you know, people might remember Newton, sort of a proto iPhone, that was built out of Japan by Sharp and then later by Inventec in Taiwan. So Apple had this really interesting history, and for years you had Apple executives from California going to Japan because that was really the base of manufacturing in the 80s and 90s, back and forth. And they really realized, like, Japan is leading by leaps and bounds, and we're just falling behind here. And that was really the basis for the PC revolution, right? There's nothing fancy about the PC. There's nothing great about Windows, per se, in terms of what Mac had been doing in the 1980s. But man, oh man, could they build and distribute computers and cut costs every month. And Steve Jobs, that was just never his skill set. And after he left the company, nobody else really filled that role. And so, in 1996, out of absolute crisis, they have to adopt a global outsourcing model. And when Steve Jobs comes back to the company, that's the model he's working with. So then they come up with the iMac. Yeah.
So, you know, when you think about outsourcing, the simple and there's so much going on in this book, and there are so many interesting sort of nuances and chapters, as you mentioned it. As we sat down to prepare for this interview, I was trying to figure out how do we take it up to a level to give people a taste of it, right? And one of the things that sort of you think of intuitively, you think of traditional outsourcing. One model would say, okay, I'm going to give you a bill of materials, and I'm going to give you a set of drawings. Just build it. Apple didn't do that. Let's talk about how different the model and how Apple got so intertwined with its Chinese manufacturing partners.
So Steve Jobs has this brilliant realization, which is that we are not going to compete on the terms set by the PC industry. In other words, if we're trying to compete on cost and on distribution, we're just never going to win. Because Apple's 5% of the market, that's probably being generous. It might have been 3%. Everybody else is using interchangeable parts and standardized machinery and whatnot. And so if Apple plays that game, it would just run them to bankruptcy even more quickly. So what they realize is that we need to completely redefine the aesthetics of the computer and give the product certain features that you can't be found in the PC world. And so what they come up with, of course, is the translucent iMac. And this thing is like totally boundary pushing when it comes to how to use the plastic injection molding tooling, for instance. I mean, no computer ever looked like this before. And so to get it done, they have to rely on their analog monitor supplier, which is LG. I mean, effectively, I don't even think LG is a contract manufacturer, but Apple just makes them so because the computer, if other than looking very sexy, it's essentially a computer, a monitor with a computer stuffed inside. And so so they sort of basically adopt this model where Korea's LG builds this computer for them. And then they sort of take themselves out of the equation. So originally, it's first being sent to Apple and then Apple shipping it to the consumer. But once the computer becomes really successful, they realize that's just not a needed step. But then what they ask is for LG to expand their operations to the triple continent model, which is something that Apple had introduced in the early 1980s. And you have to remember, you know, Moore's Law makes consolidation into one region like China really possible. Back in the days of mainframe computers, you were never going to consolidate all your production into one place and then distribute around the world, right? If a computer's the size of a garage, that's not going to make any sense. Once computers are getting to the laptop form factor, and especially to handheld products, and of course, well, I'm previewing myself, you're getting to the iPod, it makes more and more sense. So essentially, LG builds in first in South Korea, but then in Mexico, and then in Wales, right? And this is really interesting to write about, because I don't think anybody knew computers were built in those places. It's a great strategy, but in fact, it's a disaster. There are fires of various kinds in both regions that sort of put a halt to the whole idea. And Taiwanese company Foxconn really steps in, says, give me a chance, I can fix this. And they set up production lines in China, but also in the Czech Republic and in Fullerton, California. And then we're sort of off to the races, where the Foxconn-Apple partnership plays like a multi-chapter role. And in fact, it's still the number one supplier, number one assembler for Apple today. And so it's the partnership of those two companies, which is really super interesting. But of course, the fact that Foxconn is Taiwanese, you know, and modern Taiwan is effectively the losers of the Chinese Civil War from 1949, setting up their own little outpost. But trying to maintain sovereignty over the entire country makes this like such an interesting geopolitical drama. Where why do you have Taiwanese entrepreneurs effectively industrializing their counterpart, their rival, and the role that Apple and other Western companies play in that just ends up being kind of a fascinating and fairly untold story in the history of Apple.
One of the things I found myself doing as I was reading the book was I would stop and get on the internet and look at pictures of all these Apple devices, right? As we were going through this evolution, I had to pull up and look at that first iMac, and it's incredible design. Patrick, if you do another edition, you should have illustrations. But
you're right.
And also, you talk about different addresses, like the Steve Jobs announcement of the iPod, which we're going to get to. But of course, the iPhone, which we're going to get to. But again, I had to stop, pull up the YouTube video, because the stories are so extraordinary. You just mentioned Foxconn, and Foxconn is just, if you talk about the major supporting actor in this movie that is your book, Foxconn is, actually it's probably a star. Let's talk a little bit about Terry Gou and sort of his incredible approach to building Foxconn up.
Okay, so Terry Gou is the first person to really understand the value of partnering with Apple is never going to be the profits. And so what's it going to be? It's going to be the learning. And the reason why is that Apple is not building products or designing products that look like any of its rivals. And so in order to actually bring them into being, especially at the quality that Apple wants, and in particular, the quantities that Apple eventually needs, you need a whole bunch of new tools. You need different parts. This is not standardized, interchangeable parts that Dell and Compaq are using. And so to actually do it, Apple implements this program where they fly over basically it becomes America's best engineers, but Apple's best engineers over to factories in Asia and with time, increasingly China, to train entire production lines how to do this stuff. And, you know, the line that I have about this is just absolutely nuts, because you have to remember just how successful Apple ends up being and how many hundreds of millions of devices they build per year. So since 2008, Apple has trained 28 million people, which I say is larger than the entire labor force of California. So Apple operates on such a level that it's hard for, honestly, like the human mind to fathom. And so you always need comparisons like that. So they're going over to these factories and they're just training and training and training. They're auditing, they're supervising. Terms like babysit would be used sometimes by Apple engineers. But the point is that if you're a contract manufacturer, you're always trying to sort of find some way to not do things the way you're taught and instead to cut corners. And Apple's essentially there 24/7 in the factories to make sure that that doesn't happen. And they're not just allowing the suppliers to operate beyond their perceived capabilities, but their actual capabilities. Because especially in the early 2000s, Apple was purchasing what becomes tens of billions of dollars worth of machinery and placing it in these suppliers' factories. So they're allowing them to operate with machinery that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford to do. So it's just an astonishing degree of control that they have, and an astonishing like uparming of an adversarial nation that ends up becoming the sort of geopolitics of this narrative.
Yeah, it's just amazing as you go through this and you think about what an extraordinary model this is. I'm not sure, you know, this is happening anywhere else with any other company. Apple is, well, while they are supplying some of that equipment, they're effectively offloading a lot of the, you know, underlying fixed costs, right? Burdens. I mean, you talk about how whenever there would be an opportunity, Terry Gou would step up and say, we can do this and offer Apple incredible deals, because I think his vision was, look at what an incredible set of engineers I'm going to get trained. Have I basically got that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And look, that's something Terry understands in 1999. And I don't even think the Chinese suppliers really get it en masse until around 2016. And this is effectively because there's a point in which Apple basically makes this explicit to the Chinese state as a way of sort of saving themselves in the country. And then word sort of trickles out. But no, Terry just gets it. And he's basically the Henry Ford of Asia, right? I mean, James Fallows wrote in, I think, 2010, nobody is more responsible turning Shenzhen from a series of fishing villages in 1980 to a city comparable to the size of New York by 2010. Today, it's a city of some 18 million people. Because Terry doesn't just build factories. He does build a bunch of factories, and then he vertically integrates. So we think of them as the final assembler, but they do metal stamping, machine tooling, plastic ejection molding, all the things that you would sort of have adjacent to the final assembly factory sites. And in order to house all of these people, or really to have them close by, he builds dormitories. In order for them to have something to do outside of work, he builds entertainment venues, like movie theaters, like, you know, mini golf, like any sort of things. He's basically building a city within a city. And he does this in multiple industrial clusters across China. So his influence is absolutely enormous. But of course, what people forget when they're talking about Foxconn is, well, who's their biggest client? And it's been Apple for the last 25 years. So if you can understand just by the Taiwanese analogy, oh, wow, the Taiwanese entrepreneurs really built up industrial clusters in China. They absolutely did. And it's not a controversial fact. But what we're forgetting there is that it's a Western company, Apple, sort of, you know, motoring Foxconn. So really, Apple is the power that really built up these industrial clusters in China.
There are anecdotes where you have Terry Goop. Is it Goo or Gao?
I say Guo, but okay, honestly, I've heard it about three different ways.
Terry, whatever his name is, points to a vacant field with some Apple people and says, that's where your factory is going to be. And he just does these incredible production, you know, sort of creations, right?
Yeah, this is an anecdote with John Rubinstein, senior vice president of the iPod at the time. And the iPod Mini, I think it is, might be the Nano, is supposed to go online, you know, that November. And I think this is around January, February. And Terry Guo points to basically a field of trash and says, there's your factory. And John talks about basically having a panic attack on the stage because... at the time, because, you know, he's sort of thinking in a Western timeline of like, well, you're not going to be able to get the environmental paperwork done by the time we need this in a million a day. And actually, just like Terry knows better than anybody else because of all the things he's been building the prior two decades of how quickly he can go. So Terry, in a sense, is having fun with him, right? He recognizes what a Westerner is going to think. But, you know, John goes back a couple months later and the factory isn't finished. The way he describes it is that it's steel girders, except that you walk up this like this staircase and the second floor somehow is completely done. And there's workers there and they are indeed working on the products. And a few months later, they're churning out the iPods. So, yeah, I want to give loads of credit to Foxconn in particular, because some people sometimes hear me in a 90-second soundbite and they think I'm just saying Apple built China and it's all Apple, da 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 da. And it's like, no, you don't understand. The book goes into considerable detail on how Foxconn in particular, Terry Guo, but also like the Chinese suppliers just offered something that, you know, Apple couldn't find any place else, right? The industrial policy, the hardworking people, just so many things that I find would be really difficult for India, let alone the United States, to replicate. So China is an absolutely key partner. You might even call it the secret sauce.
So back in the day, when you wanted to buy a Mac, you'd go to a Mac store. And then Apple eventually saw the retail side and opened their own stores. And then they opened stores in China. What were some of the challenges of opening the Apple store in China?
So this is my favorite part of the narrative. And what's so great, I'll just give you sort of behind-the-scenes writer logic. I wrote a 70-page book pitch, and nobody seems to have caught up with it when we were talking to publishers about the book. But I had a massive hole in that I didn't know what was interesting about the birth of the iPhone in 2007. I mean, obviously, that's a massive deal for Apple. But I had nothing original to say until 2013, when Apple has its political awakening. In other words, I'd already sort of sourced the political awakening part, where they sort of have to get real on what's going on in China. And so what ends up happening is I cover the birth of China as a retail market. So Apple only builds a store in Beijing, the Sanlitun District, because the Beijing Olympics are being held in 2008. Everyone assumes it's going to lose money. It's a bad idea. You know, why are we in China? Because there's hundreds of millions of poor people that can build our devices. And you're not going to sell $500 or $600 phones to people. They can't afford it. I mean, remember, Steve Ballmer didn't think Americans would buy the iPhone for $500 or $600. So why would a developing country? So the logic is sort of off, and they just assume this is a great marketing deal because of 10,000 athletes from around the world and all the TV coverage, but we're going to lose money. Instead, it just sort of knocks it out of the park right away. And by 2010, when the iPhone 4 comes out, there are four stores in China. What happens is the demand in China for the iPhone 4 and the iPad, which has just come out, just becomes like totally gangbusters. Like it is the conspicuous consumption product that you want to indicate that you're young, you're Western, you're with it, you're cool. And Apple just can't keep up with the demand. And so what happens is these gangsters that are called yellow cows, they're effectively scalpers, they end up trying to purchase as many products as possible. The problem is Apple only lets you buy two. So how do you buy 10,000 iPhones a day if you're only allowed to buy two? Well, you bus in 5,000 migrants from outside Beijing, right? Literally on buses, they snake around the line. Everyone's allowed to buy two. And so Apple, you know, if you can picture, you've probably seen this before, like the conveyor belt logic and efficiency of assembling an iPhone, that model effectively becomes what happens in the Apple store, where the people are coming in with the exact same wads of cash and Apple's sort of sitting there. Remember, this is a total cash-based society in 2010. So Apple employees are sitting there counting the money, you know, making sure it's legit or whatever. But every minute they're processing a phone transaction. And so the San Leighton store alone is selling 25,000 stores a day because these gangsters can literally fill a bus full of iPhones and go to a city like Chongqing. You know, most viewers probably haven't heard of the city. Population 32 million in 2010, and they can be the monopolist distributor of the iPhone, like the most coveted product at the time. Now, not to get too ahead of myself or give away the whole narrative, this is four or five chapters in the book, and I just got to tell you, it's absolutely wild. I mean, people are selling kidneys on the black market in order to acquire new Apple products. I mean, demand is just absolutely off the charts. But they go from helping Apple, in a sense, of being like a gig economy type distributor, to really being a major problem that takes Apple some 8 years to solve. Because what they end up doing is hollowing out the components and replacing them with lookalike parts, and then selling these phones to people who are then complaining that the Apple products aren't functioning. And in a sense, the complaints about those products make their way up to the highest levels of the Communist Party, such that a day after Xi Jinping enters office, Apple is brutally attacked harsh, like three-week indictment against the company. So it ends up being this massive political problem for Apple, even as it earns them billions of dollars.
One of the things that was, again, there are wonderful narratives and wonderful stories, and I want to come back to the guy that Apple sent to set up this store who thought he was getting into one kind of gig, and obviously it was very different. But one of the things that would happen is, I take it, people would take black market Apple devices back to an Apple store and say, this doesn't work, you need to replace it. And I think what set off the tension was that Apple would analyze and go, this isn't real, and refuse to do it. And then people would get angry. Is that basically one of the things that kicked off this problem?
So it's difficult to underestimate the sophistication here. So this happens in stages. So eventually, initially people in China are just buying the phones and then going to a city where they don't have the Apple store and selling them that way. But they get greedy, right? So instead what they start doing is realizing that China has a 20% value added tax. So if you can acquire them from Hong Kong or from a tax-free state like Oregon, and then going to China, you're sort of making 20% more than your other yellow cow rivals. Okay, even better is if you go to Verizon in the United States using a fake ID and you buy an iPhone with a 24-month contract. In other words, you acquire an iPhone for less than $100 because you're only paying the first installment of a 24-month plan that you're never going to pay. And then you go back to China. Now, savvy listeners will say, well, that doesn't make sense because you can't just buy an iPhone. It operates on a different frequency. It says that it's not for the Chinese market, etc. And that's true. So what they do is they use these factory connections to literally burn out the CPU. And by doing so, they're rendering the phone inoperable, but they're also masking where it was purchased. And so then they're going to the iPhone store, right? So instead of sort of everybody snake lining around the store at the entrance, they're actually snake lining a store at the Genius Bar, and they're saying over and over, my phones don't work. I mean, I talked to Apple executives who'd say, you'd have a young kid there who'd have a backpack full of broken, you know, deliberately broken iPhones, just saying one after the other, this one doesn't work, and this one doesn't work, and this one doesn't work. And so it's just absolutely astonishing. And Apple doesn't know what's going on. At first, they think they have a supply chain problem. You know, they built the chips and they've screwed up somehow. And eventually they catch wind of it. But it's just this wild narrative where Apple's dealing with scalpers and trying to sort of perform their courteous service, but at the same time recognize that they're actually being scammed, and they have to sort of find a balance in a place that's, you know, it's politically taboo to just like, you know, go out and complain about this openly. And so the tables sort of get flipped on them where you've got these fake Apple stores that aren't accepting these rejects, and then the people don't know that they're fake because even the employees think they work for Apple. It's just an absolutely wild narrative where again, the complaints just go to the highest levels of the Communist Party, and Apple has to realize, like, we don't understand what we're doing here. We don't understand Apple Chinese culture. We don't understand Chinese politics. We need people in the country on the ground who can figure these things out for us. And that's the start of the next section called Political Awakening.
And before we go, we're getting to the end of our time together. By the way, I think our listeners can tell this book is filled with great stories. Patrick, where does Apple go from here? They are so embedded in China. How big a threat is that relationship to the future of the company?
So the biggest kind of thesis or the biggest contribution the book makes to Apple history is that, you know, we think of Apple products as being built in China because there's a lot of competent suppliers there. And so it's just a nice place to go. There's abundant labor and so forth. The real thesis of the book is that Apple didn't go to China because it found competence there. It went to China because it could build the competence there. And so the amount of investment it makes into Chinese factories ends up being tens of billions of dollars per year. I mean, they're training just millions of people per year, right? I mean, the number that comes from Tim Cook is how many people are assembling products in China is 3 million. And it's not the same 3 million in 2015 as it is in 2018. I don't even know that there'd be more than a few at that point. The churn in these factories is so incredible that, you know, at one point, the single factory from Pegatron in the Pudong district of Shanghai had 100,000 employees working on Apple products, but they were losing 25,000 a month, which meant they had to hire 25,000 a month, right? So the average duration of how long an employee would stay was just 62 days or something, maybe 65 days. So the number of people that are leaving all the time and therefore need more training is just incredible. So, you know, we think of Apple University as this like corporate thing where, you know, Steve Jobs gets to teach values that will maintain its culture, you know, after his death. But like really, Apple University is the vocational school in China where millions of people have been trained, not just on how to build Apple products, but in much beyond. So yeah, I mean, basically the book is trying to tell three stories in one. The greatest corporate turnaround ever, from near bankruptcy to $3 trillion company. The story of how Apple actually makes its products and how it built the world's most sophisticated supply chain centered in China. And then the geopolitical dilemma of what does it mean to tie your fate to a country just as it turns belligerent and authoritarian and becomes America's biggest rival. So it's a pretty wild narrative.
It is a very wild narrative. 30 seconds before we go. How vulnerable are Apple and the other U.S. tech companies as a result of the role of the chips made by TSMC?
Oh, TSMC, gosh. Yeah, it's so hard to squeeze this in. I mean, 90% of the world's most advanced products all come from a single company in Taiwan, TSMC. So far, so good. Taiwan's a great ally. The problem is Xi Jinping thinks of Taiwan as a rogue province that needs to be reincorporated. And it's, you can't just take over an island and take control of their fabs, right? Their semiconductor foundries. That's just not, it's not like oil, it's not like gold. You have to keep things up and running, and TSMC itself relies on a global distribution network. I mean, TSMC has been called the first company in the world where if it were to stop producing, the world would enter a global recession. And for Apple in particular, it would be the equivalent of a meteor strike.
We could talk about this for another hour, but we're out of time. Patrick McGee, thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
My pleasure.
The book is Apple in China by Patrick McGee. We'll be right back after this.